From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the March 2018 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Secrets revealed. In this month's It Happened Here episode, we're looking into the Hut 3 headlines. These were summaries of the most important top secret intercepted messages. Hut 3 worked on deciphered Enigma messages sent by the German Army and Air Force. These messages were boiled down to the most succinct form of intelligence, often just one sentence, giving Churchill crucial information on how Germany saw the progress of the war on that day. Now Bletchley Park is revealing some of these secrets for the first time, publishing the digitised original Hut 3 headlines. Batch 1 has 10 carefully selected messages, and in this episode, we're going to take a closer look at three of them. Podcast producer Mark Cotton has been talking to Bletchley Park's senior archivist Guy Revel about why he didn't want to keep these treasures locked away. I've met one of the dedicated volunteers who scan these precious pieces of history, Dennis Falvey, along with Florence Morgan Richards, Bletchley Park's digitisation and archive assistant, who runs the project. And special thanks go to Mr. Ben Thompson for playing the part of our Hut 3 intelligence officer in this episode. First, let's find out just how important the Hut 3 headlines were, from Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
David, do we know such a thing as when the first Hut 3 headline was?
Well, the first Hut 3 headline, number one, is sent in May 1941. But this is the formalisation of a process that's been going on since the summer of 1940. More or less as soon as Bletchley started breaking Enigma traffic and Air Force traffic mainly, Churchill took an interest. He was very keen on signals intelligence and had been, even when he was out of office during the 1930s, he still found ways to keep up to date with intelligence information. So he was very keen to be informed about everything that happened. The problem with this was his idea, send me everything, wasn't going to work because there's far too much traffic for him to read it all. So a system was developed whereby Bletchley would send material to SIS in London, to Stuart Mingy's, who was C, and then he would, or his staff would, create a summary of the most important information that would then go in a little folder, and every morning Churchill would get one of those. In fact, he'd get three. He would get Hut 3 headlines, which dealt with Army and Air Force intelligence. He would get naval headlines, and he would get a thing called a blue jacket, which was diplomatic intercept information. So he had those three folders. And typically, Mingy's would also write a little sort of introductory page, little covering note, if you like, to keep him informed about what it was.
So he had a fair bit to plough through, even with this incredible boil down of so much information. Was the idea sort of led by Churchill himself with this tell me everything approach? But of course, they can't tell him everything, as you say. It has to be boiled down. Whose job was it to decide what we ultimately tell the boss each day?
Well, the person who was put in charge of this was Fred Winterbottom, who's more famous for writing the first book about Bletchley Park back in the 1970s. He was head of air intelligence at SIS, and it kind of fell to him because a lot of the early material was Luftwaffe traffic. But he is placed in charge of deciding what should be sent and organising for its delivery and everything else. And in his book, he describes how he would prepare these bulletins every day, but also if anything particularly important came in the course of the day, he would sometimes telephone Churchill in person and actually tell him, sort of read over the phone, really important intercept. He talks about being quite intimidated by that the first time he did it, but familiarity made him more comfortable with it. So mainly his role is to identify what's important and what's not important.
So it fell to just one man to make those decisions day to day. I envisaged people discussing what to include and what not, and there perhaps having been disagreements. That wouldn't have happened then.
Well, he's not reading all the traffic. I mean, he's getting a supply from Hut 3, and the watch officers in Hut 3, part of their job, they read all the raw traffic and they do a prioritisation process at that stage. So Hut 3 would have collectively known what to pass on to Winterbottom, and then Winterbottom would have made a further selection of that, of what to pass on to Churchill. So it gets weeded at several stages.
Group Captain Freddie Winterbotham, then Chief of Air Intelligence for the British Secret Intelligence Service, or MI6 as we probably know it. Now in his 80th year, Freddie Winterbotham is on a brief visit to Sydney, and he's sitting opposite me right now. Thank you for joining us on the programme, sir. How did you get into the spying business in the first place? How were you recruited to MI6?
Well, I suppose that was being the right person, the right place, the right time, really, because I decided I'd want to go back to the air staff. I'd been shot down as a prisoner of war in the First World War, and I was a fighter pilot at that time. And I'd spent some time regaining my health, and then I decided that I wanted a job, and I went to London to see my old friends at the Air Ministry. And it just happened that this post was just coming up, because the Air Force hadn't had their own part of the Secret Service till that time. I spoke some languages. I was reasonably old, so to speak. I was responsible. I knew my air business.
How old were you at the time?
I was 33 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they seemed to think I got on with people, as I did, because I travelled a great deal and I was able to talk to people, whether they had brass hats or whether they hadn't. And I was put on the short list, and then I finally got the job and went to work in January 1930. So it was only when I went up in January 1930 that I was taken quietly in a taxi cab across London and introduced to my chief, who was then the chief of the Secret Service, a delightful old admiral. And I was told what my job was really going to be. It was all terribly exciting, of course.
Was he known by a code name?
He was known as C, yes.
Not M?
No. M is a nice Bond model, I think.
What did he say to you at that time?
He welcomed me very much and said that, as I just learned, that was going to be my job, and he would introduce me to all my colleagues, the Army and the Navy and so forth, and they would put me right as to where I could get the agents and get the information I wanted.
When was the first time you went into Germany as an agent?
In 1934. And this was frowned upon, of course, because executives at headquarters in London were not supposed to travel. You were supposed to do your spying at long range through other people and so forth.
Mm.
But I found it impossible to get agents in Germany who could tell me anything about the air rearmament. Firstly, I think it was a great euphoria for Nazism. And secondly, there was a pistol behind anybody's head who got found out, and the Gestapo were very active. And everybody clamped down completely.
And I know that your book is called The Ultra Secret, in which you describe what must be one of the greatest coups, if not the greatest coup, in the Second World War, the breaking of the famous German code that was the basis, as I understand it, of all their intelligence and something they valued more highly than anything else. How did this come about?
We realized that the Germans, if they were going to carry out the sort of blitzkrieg which had been explained to me by Reichenau, that speed of communication was absolutely necessary, but we could not find out exactly how they were going to do it. It must be secret, it must be quick, it must be easy. And fortunately, the Polish Secret Service, who'd be next to the Germans, had a very good agent in the factory that was building the German cipher machine called the Enigma machine.
Mm-hmm.
And this was going to be their principal form of communication. And the Poles managed to get the sufficient information out to rebuild a model. And just before the war broke out in September, they thought, well, this isn't going to be any use to us, and they gave the machine to us. Now, that enabled us to pull it to pieces and find out how it worked, or try to find out how it worked.
Mm.
It was rather like a sort of small electric fruit machine with the drums going round, but there were letters instead of fruit on it and so forth, and it proliferated the letters that you put into it. If you tapped the typewriter A, that would be proliferated through these drums to such an extent that unless you knew exactly which letters to put in front of you to start the message, you only had one chance in 4 million of finding out. So the Germans had every reason to believe that this cipher machine was absolutely safe.
So let's talk a little bit about the mechanics of the Hut 3 headlines. Was there just one message a day to Churchill?
There's not ever really one message a day. In the early days, you get a headline that might list a series of serial numbers on it of different messages. And, you know, one headline sheet might have four or five different pieces of information on it. These survive in our archive as copies of teleprinter traffic messages, because essentially they went from here to Broadway buildings, which is the SAS headquarters, by teleprinter. And actually, if you look on the documents, they have BB as a sort of the address line at the top, which stands for Broadway buildings. Latterly, they get sent to some other recipients as well. You see ADY for Admiralty on there as well. So they're being copied to the Admiralty. But mainly they go to Broadway buildings. And initially you get one or two headlines a day, headline sheets with between four and six messages on the sheet. The system evolves so that through 1942 into 43, they tend to generate a fresh sheet for every message. And rather than saving up four or five messages and sending them perhaps at the end of the shift, they're sending stuff as it becomes available. So you end up with far more headlines. And because they're sequentially numbered, we have that first one in May 1941, and then the numbers rack up. You can actually see more and more serial numbers being used each week until there's a point in 1942 where there are over 100 separate headlines sent within 10 days. So the volume's increasing constantly. I mean, whether Churchill still found time to read all 100 is an interesting question, but
maybe he had them triaged at his end by somebody in his coterie. In their incredible brevity, how much do they actually tell us? Or is it a sort of a cue to look into that subject?
They are a cue to what Bletchley might know more about. I mean, you're not going to get much from the headlines themselves necessarily, but if you know, having looked at them, that there was traffic available on a particular topic on a particular day, then there are ways of finding more material on that in the archives. The other thing they're useful for is showing what people thought was important, you know, and what the Prime Minister thought was important. And the other collection, because there are several sets of these that survive, the set that's in the National Archives has Churchill's pen and ink annotations on them. So you can see actually his response to things going, you know, oh, I want to know more about this or whatever.
The first batch of 10 are now available online for people to peruse at their leisure. But we couldn't look through all 10 in this episode because we'd be here all day. So much as they did during the war at Bletchley Park, we've had to narrow it down to choose what to look more closely at. So we've picked three.
Most secret. Broadway building for section 2 only. Admiralty for DNI personal. Hut 3, headlines 2899. CX-MSS-2040-T31. At 1300 hours, 30th of January 1943. Strong Russian attack breaks German lines in Stalingrad.
It's an admission that things aren't going well, isn't it?
It is. It's a report of basically the final offensive that the Russians made in the capture of Stalingrad in January 43. In fact, this message comes in on the 30th. And it was on the 2nd of February, so just 48 hours later, that von Paulus actually surrendered and the battle was over as far as the Germans were concerned. So it's giving Churchill and the Allies kind of advance notice that that is about to happen, essentially. It shows it's kind of the high watermark of German ambition in Russia, and after this, it's all backwards again.
The heroic defense of Stalingrad. The Soviet army turning the Nazi six-month assault into the most ghastly military disaster in German history. Hands held high, the beaten Nazis pour from house after house in abject surrender. Hitler's generals give up too, 24, including a field marshal. Here is Lieutenant General von Daniel, commander of the veteran 376th Division. Lieutenant General San commanded Hitler's pride, the crack 100th Division that smashed through Belgium and France. Berlin says that German generals never surrender. Germany's Romanian allies, Brigadier General Dimitriou,
commander of the 20th Romanian Infantry, suffers the same fate as that of his German colleagues. 5 more Axis generals who failed at the Stalingrad, Hitler vowed he'd take. Lieutenant General Schlemmer, whose 14th Tank Corps helped conquer Holland. Lieutenant General von Greber, whose 297th Infantry invaded Greece. Lieutenant General Rinaldi, medical chief of the 6th German Army. Biggest catch of all, Field Marshal Friedrich von Paulus, commander-in-chief of all Axis armies at Stalingrad. Taken to headquarters of General Shumilov for questioning, von Paulus has much to answer for. Calmly, quietly, General Shumilov reviews von Paulus' record. This is the von Paulus who, 2 months before, threatened the families of his own soldiers with death if one man should surrender. Berlin claimed he was captured only because he was gravely wounded. Actually, a young Red Army lieutenant found him hiding in the basement of a department store and brought him in without a struggle. These also gave up. Cold, starved, emaciated, defeated. Remnants of 22 beaten Nazi divisions. Now they plod toward a Russian prison. Proudly, the red flag flies again over the heroic city of Stalin as endless lines of Nazi prisoners write the final chapter in the Battle of Stalingrad. Here, the might of the German 6th Army met the courage of a people fighting for life and liberty.
It shows that the Germans are still having to, even though Hitler didn't like bad news, if you like, this stuff is still being reported. The German army is still having to communicate the truth around in terms of its own internal communications networks. And this is why Enigma is so important, because we're hearing from the horse's mouth more or less exactly what's going on. This will have been pulled from traffic on the Eastern Front, German radio messages in Russia that were, when the weather was right, actually audible in the UK and could be intercepted.
You've been on the show before, Guy, specifically that time talking about the Japanese school in Bedford. But can you give us more of a general overview of the archive and, you know, what you do and what its purpose is, really?
The archive collection held by the Bletchley Park Trust is of international significance. It gives a unique insight into the code-breaking activities that took place at Bletchley Park and at the outstations associated with Bletchley Park, and the crucial impact of Bletchley Park's ultra-intelligence on all spheres of the war. As much of the material evidence for the code-breaking effort was destroyed after the war, and Bletchley Park remained a closely guarded secret until the 1970s, the documents in the archive give a rare and important glimpse into the story we are still uncovering.
I mean, we're sat here, we're just surrounded by boxes, aren't we?
Yes, hundreds of boxes, lovely new boxes, which we're going to use to improve the storage conditions of a lot of our archive. If I give you a few examples of the kinds of major collections, we have over 1,100 volumes of mostly German language message transcripts for radio communications between Abwehr networks, the German intelligence service. We have runs of intelligence reports relating to the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe. Lots of records of the state of Axis shipping, so Japanese, Italian and German. An example there might be the records of the torpedo use by German U-boats. Here we have a small book in which on each page is identified an individual submarine, and then cross-referenced with that are the messages sent by that submarine, which contain details of the torpedoes that have been fired, what type those torpedoes were, and whether they hit their target or they missed the target.
Oh, right, so these were being collated here, were they?
Yes, indeed, yes. Oh, right. So there's a running count of the state of the torpedo usage of the entire German Navy, as long as we're able to break those particular messages.
There's just so much, isn't there?
There is, all sorts of areas. We have working aids used to aid the decryption of the messages, and we've got lots of sort of glossaries and indexes that would help people to understand the content of the message, because quite often you would need help in understanding it. You might come across an abbreviation that you personally have never been faced with in a message, but you could go and see if it's in the index. And if it's there, it might tell you that ZPG is the abbreviation for a new type of torpedo.
I mean, the archive's role mainly is to save these documents because, I mean, at the end of the war, there was nothing, was there, really?
There was nothing made available to the public through the Public Record Office, now the National Archives. What was deemed important to GCHQ, that was bundled up and taken with them to their new facility in London. And the material really only became available to the public in the 1990s. The material that's available to the public now is split between the National Archives and between the Bletchley Park Trust, and the two are complementary. And one area in which we are superior, if I can use that word, to the National Archives is that they don't have a remit to cover individual archives, so material collected by veterans, individuals who served here or with the affiliate outstations and organisations.
The episode we did on Japanese codebreaking, that material had come from someone who went to the school and actually then gave this material to us, didn't they?
That's correct, yes. So we are the go-to repository for material which veterans have been able to hold on to and then donate to us. So we've got all sorts of things, obviously not necessarily in great detail about their work because that was secret. Around that, sort of their social life, what it was like to be in the ATS or the RAF and be working at Bletchley Park. We've got a very strong collection on the drama club and the recreational society. We've used a lot of that material in the off-duty exhibition currently in the mansion, programs and scripts and even rehearsal schedules. So depending on who you are, if your relative was in the drama group, it might be possible to tell you where they were, what role they were playing, in what play, and what words they spoke, which for people who are at a secret site, I think is pretty good going.
Yeah, well, we have a recording that the BBC made in 1945 of the marriage of Figaro, don't we?
Yes.
And I mean, in last month's episode, we had Pat Field being interviewed. Pat's playing on that recording. It seems impossible to think the most secret place in Britain, the BBC were here recording a concert.
Yeah, that becomes slightly more understandable if you realise that the concert wasn't taking place inside the fence line, but it was Bletchley Park service personnel who were involved in it, but outside of the fence line.
I mean, this material we received from the veterans is just pure gold, isn't it?
Indeed, and as well as the material contemporaneous to their service, a lot of them, since the secret has become more widely known, they'll have given lectures or they'll have written memoirs for their family, and we are now the repository for those. So people's memories, what they're holding in their head, the intangible heritage, is being put down on paper or in an electronic form and coming here and being preserved for posterity.
And that's what this whole project's about, is actually making these materials more available, aren't they? Because not just three headlines as our first release, but the second release is actually diary entries, isn't it?
That's right, diary entries and letters, yes. What is the point in us preserving all this material if no one can access it? Now, one of the things that we can do with digitisation is to preserve the original material by providing access to the electronic version. So the original version has less handling, less stress. It can remain in its environment where it has the best chance of survival. But also, because it's electronic, it can be made available to a much wider audience through the medium of the internet.
So does this excite you, the fact that these documents that, you know, up to this point, there's only a handful of people who've seen these, really, since their first use, obviously, during the war. But does it excite you to think that potentially millions of people could see these if they wanted?
Oh, yes, of course, yes. I mean, as I say, I don't think it's overstating it to say they're of worldwide significance in a historical sense. And so we are making them available to anyone who has even a passing interest. I mean, the variety of material is, as I say, from veterans' recollections down to individual messages telling you about the state of German morale on the Eastern Front. So there's a whole scope of interest there. There's family history, there's military history, things around social history, the history of your locality, all sorts of things. Obviously, the messages and the analyses that were conducted by some of the staff at Bletchley that were analysing the messages to get the intelligence out of them. It can tell you all sorts of things about the history of any particular point that was touched by the war.
Material in the archive then plays into us being able to open new exhibitions. You've spoken about off-duty. Next month, we're opening our new exhibition in Hut 11A, all about the bomb. And there's some material that's going to be released in conjunction with that as well, isn't there?
That's correct. So the new exhibition in Hut 11A about the bomb machine will feature some original drawings, both blueprints and white prints, that were used to construct the original bomb machines. And that selection is from the several thousand original bomb drawings that we hold. And some of the drawings that are going on display, they'll form the basis of the next Collections Uncovered album, which we'll be releasing online to coincide with the opening of the exhibition.
So, as an archivist, how does this make you feel? Because I suppose anyone looking at your job would be you sit in small, dank rooms looking through musty boxes and this stuff shouldn't see the light of day. But does this make you happy to know that this stuff's going out there?
Well, first off, I don't think I've ever experienced that common perception of the archivist. It's not really like that. We
Maybe it's my conception, maybe. I don't know.
I'm not sure where that conception came from, but I can certainly say that at Bletchley, it's not like that. We've got lovely, bright storerooms, brand new boxes. All our material is going in new, inert plastic enclosures to help protect it from deterioration so we can keep it for as long as possible. And we have a kind of clinical environment almost, trying to keep it clean and a particular humidity and temperature and keep the dirt out and the insects out. And we have programs to monitor all of those things, of course. But yes, making it available to the public, I mean, as I said, what's the point in us having it and then hoarding it? No, it's ours, it's secret, you can't know. We want to make it public. We want to celebrate the achievements of the veterans and the organisation at Bletchley Park.
For Broadway Building and Admiralty, Top Secret Ultra, Hut 3, Headlines 337, CX-MSS-T255-8, at 1100 hours, 22nd of July 1944. The plot of cowardly officers against the Führer was wholly liquidated in 6 hours.
The wording of this one's quite interesting. The plot of cowardly officers against the Führer. Whose words are they?
I'm not exactly sure of the source of this message, but what it refers to is the 20th of July conspiracy against Hitler, the bomb plot in Rastenburg in East Prussia. People who've seen the Tom Cruise movie Valkyrie is that story. It's where a number of senior German officers decided that the war was going against Germany and that Hitler was no longer the best person to run the operation. And so they planted a bomb in his headquarters. The bomb didn't kill Hitler. He was only slightly injured. It killed another couple of other people. And the idea was that as soon as Hitler was dead, messages would go out and they would basically, the conspirators would take over Germany and set up a new government and negotiate with Britain and the US to end the war in the West, basically. Unfortunately, as soon as it became clear Hitler wasn't dead, the whole thing fell apart. Some of the people who were involved but sitting on the fence, if you like, jumped back onto the side of the Nazis and kind of shocked everybody else. Stauffenberg, who's the most famous of the conspirators, was dead within 24 hours. He was arrested and sort of sentenced by a kangaroo court and shot on the 21st of July. So the whole thing collapsed.
Swift and brutal.
Very, very swiftly. But this message is the following day, or the 22nd, when kind of the dust was settling on the thing a little bit. But Bletchley has been able to kind of follow events. There is another intercept, which doesn't appear in the Hut 3 headlines, where Bletchley was able to decrypt a partial message where the radio operator was sending, you know, Hitler is dead, there is a new government, and then it just stops abruptly, where whoever was sending the message just stopped in mid-flow because, you know, someone had come into the room or whatever.
Or and because it shows, they'd been shot, possibly.
Yeah, certainly they were. The message was no longer relevant.
Maybe dramatising, but that's what springs to my mind.
So it's, again, it's a really significant moment in the history of the war because, of course, if Hitler had been killed, who knows what would have happened at that point.
Operations room, Hitler's headquarters, following the attempt on the Führer's life. These are the German newsreel pictures put out to dispel rumour in the Reich. Rumour which, if anything, has grown over the weeks of his continued silence. According to Goebbels, everyone at the conference, with the exception of General Korten and the Führer, was blown out of the windows by the bomb. A black-cloaked Hitler stands on the platform to welcome the deflated Duce. From beneath concealing folds, he extends his left hand in greeting.
The story has been romanticised a little bit because there's this idea that these conspirators because they were against Hitler, they were somehow the good guys. That's much more of a grey area, because their ambitions weren't to turn Germany back into a democracy by any means, and they weren't planning to give up the war against the Russians or any of the German territory in the East. And a number of them are implicated in war crimes of various sorts. So
more of a power grab.
It's more of a power grab.
Than an ideological difference.
Than a big ideological difference. And so it's one of those stories that gets kind of...
Well, that's the sad reality, isn't it? That's more likely to be true than someone trying to rise up against the tyranny of the Nazi regime, which is actually what the Allies were trying to do at that very moment. But the language is very interesting. It's so brief but powerful. Cowardly officers, wholly liquidated. I don't think I've ever heard the term wholly liquidated.
I mean, it's a bit of an exaggeration to say it was wholly liquidated in 6 hours. I mean, the plot had failed to all intents and purposes in 6 hours. The bomb went off at about 12:45 lunchtime, and by that evening, people were on the run because it was all over. The repercussions continued for the rest of the war. I mean, the Germans carried on hunting down people they considered to be conspirators right up until May 1945. People were still being executed right up to the last minute, and something like 4,500 people were executed, many of whom had nothing to do with it at all, but, you know, somebody under torture had mentioned their name, and so they got implicated.
World News Today, brought to you by shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations and leading news centres in our own country. CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Douglas Edwards.
The last 18 hours has brought the greatest air attacks of all time against Germany. Thousands of Allied heavy bombers attacked military targets in the Cologne area within 40 miles of the battleground at Aachen, where American ground troops continue to make some progress. The German DNB news agency has announced the death of Field Marshal Rommel. DNB said the Desert Fox died of severe head wounds received in a car accident while serving as commander of a German army group on the Western Front. Moscow has just reported that Russian troops have captured Petsamo, Finland's great northern port. And now for details of the fighting in Western Europe, Larry Lesser reporting.
The other historical debate, if you like, is because Rommel is forced to commit suicide shortly after in 1944, because he has been implicated in the plot. The question is asked to what extent he was active in the plot, how anti-Hitler he actually was. And because he's quite a popular figure in sort of military historical culture, he was a great general. There are some historians who like to paint him as more anti-Nazi than he perhaps was.
And so, none of these people may have been anti-Nazi as such. They were anti-Hitler. And that's a different thing.
That's a different thing.
A dissent against the boss. It's not the same as dissent against the cause, is it?
And also, if you're a senior commander and somebody comes to you and says, we might be getting rid of the boss man, the best plan at that point in a situation like Nazi Germany is to equivocate, is to sit on the fence and see which way the wind blows. You know, so
dangerous,
I think there are huge numbers of people who hadn't blown the plot to Hitler, but probably knew about it, but at the same time covering their bases either way, if you know what I mean. And I think Rommel will probably fall into that camp. But the irony is his death, he is one of Germany's better commanders. And he's a great loss to their armed forces and their campaign in the West when he dies. So, again, you know, had he lived, had Hitler died, you know, the ramifications of it are enormous.
Marschall Rommel ist tot. Der Held von Afrika, der 2 Jahre lang durch eine wendige und einfallsreiche Führung und einen großen persönlichen Mut eine vielfache Übermacht des Feindes in Schach hielt. In einem Staatsakt nimmt das deutsche Volk Abschied von einem seiner tapfersten Generale. Mit ihm, so sagte der Führer in einem Tagesbefehl, ist einer unserer besten Heerführer dahingegangen. Sein Name ist im gegenwärtigen Schicksalskampf des deutschen Volkes der Begriff für hervorragende Tapferkeit und unerschrockenes Draufgängertum geworden. Generalfeldmarschall von Rundstedt legt nach seiner Gedenkrede den Kranz des Führers nieder. Die Bevölkerung einer süddeutschen Stadt umsäumt den letzten Weg des großen Soldaten.
It's a staggering number of people you mentioned, 4,500 or thereabouts, that ended up dead over this plot. Very useful information this side of the fence, though, isn't it? To know not only that there'd been this attempt, but it was squashed, and how forcefully the authorities in the Nazi regime wanted their own people to know that it was squashed. There was nothing to it. It's over.
There is a story that when the plot was reported by the BBC, I don't know how much truth there is in this, that when the plot was reported by the BBC mentioned several Germans in connection with it who were then rounded up. So,
but they were.
You know.
Oh, dear.
You don't need that, do you?
It speaks to me, that message of them wanting to play it down.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's saying, oh, you may have heard that something happened, but don't worry about it. It was nipped in the bud. It was dealt with. Because in the first hours of the plot, the plotters had a system set up to communicate with all the branches of the German armed forces, and they had people set up in different parts of Europe who would sort of step up and take over responsibility for those areas. And so, you know, there's a lot of people who would have had a message that morning saying, the Führer is dead, so-and-so is now in charge, you need to do this and this. And they go, hang on, what's that all about? And then a few hours later, they get a message saying, no, ignore that, that didn't happen, don't worry about that.
I'm joined by Florence Morgan Richards, Bletchley Park's digitisation and archive assistant, and a long-serving volunteer, Dennis Falvey. Florence, let's start with you. What drew you to this kind of work?
I'm interested in history of lots of different sorts, and what really interests me in working with museums is working with physical objects, these physical sort of remnants of the past, and how you can learn more about the past through looking at them and working with them closely, and is that connection with the past as well.
It's not only the information contained on a piece of paper, is it? It's the fact that the paper exists and how different that is from now.
Yes, the piece of paper itself, yes.
And the way that it would have moved through the world. That's all history now, isn't
it? Yeah, it's totally changed.
And obviously Bletchley Park's archive is moving online gradually. So
that's
tell
right.
us about the progress of the digitisation here.
Yes, so the digitisation project has been running for about 7 years, and we have got to the point now where the collections are being put on the internet, which is really great in terms of being able to let everybody see it. And it's also really nice to finally have some physical output of the project that the volunteers have been working so hard on for all of this time. There are 330,000 scans of the collections that have been made to date. Not all of these scans have been made on site. It would have just been far too much for the volunteers to do on site. But so some of that was done off site. There is several years worth left to do, but I feel that finally we're making really good progress in getting things online. So we've been working on the Hut 3 headlines recently. And the Hut 3 headlines are the highlights, the most important messages as perceived on that day, which were released to go to Churchill himself. And they're really wonderful. They're such a rich resource.
So you were looking at all the Hut 3 headlines that have been scanned today. And are they all now scanned and stored?
All of the Hut 3 headlines, 47 books of them, 300 messages in each book. They have now all been digitised. And we've got two separate programmes for online release for these Hut 3 headlines. The first project is a series of albums. We released the first album in January of the Hut 3 headlines, 10 of some of our favourites, although they're all so rich that it was very difficult to choose which ones. So they're being released in that format, but later in the year, we're hoping to release them in a fuller format. And Dennis, you've been working on checking an optical character recognition output.
Certainly have.
So what we've been doing is we've been feeding the scans that we've made of the Hut 3 headlines through an optical character recognition reader, which converts all of these messages or the pictures of the messages into a great big long Word file.
We sit there on a Monday morning and we go through them. And my thought that OCR would be wonderful is amazingly inaccurate at times. Mm-hmm. And we literally will go through and put things in so you can read them. You're sitting there and you're actually reading history as well, because we've got both documents in front of us on the screen. And some of the things that you start to learn, you very quickly understand that this must have been a massive process with the 8,000 to 10,000 people that worked here, it's quite easy to see why you need that many people. It's a real eye-opener sometimes when you see this amount of information and how they used it.
It's interesting, isn't it, how little bits of history and little avenues of history will open up.
And I think that these small avenues of history, which currently aren't really in-depth investigated, in 10, 15 years' time, the next generations of university students will be coming into the archive online and starting to do dissertations, maybe even PhDs, on subjects relating to that period of history using the archive here at Bletchley.
Well, you talk about the amount of information. What always strikes me about the Hut 3 headlines is just how little information it is, how they've boiled down an entire day into quite often one sentence.
Yes, one line.
And, you know, who and how was it being decided? What does Churchill need to know today?
What I found when looking through the Hut 3 headlines to try and pick out what was said on particularly prominent days from the war that we now remember, it was so interesting at what wasn't mentioned as well. So obviously what the British at the time thought wasn't important, which we now know in hindsight to have been the real turning point in the war. And so I found that very interesting, because I suppose the Hut 3 headlines are through two lenses. It's the lens of what the Germans knew and what they thought was important, but then that's the British looking at that.
One of the things that was quite exciting as a volunteer, that you come in here and when we're doing the Hut 3 headlines, some of it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. Tiny snippets of information. And as Florence says, some of the information, you read it and think, wow, but you've actually got the documents in your hands. And when we've finished as individuals doing our part of the process, those documents will go back into the book. And it could be a very, very long time again before someone actually picks them up. And sometimes you do get a very sort of goosebump feeling that you're working with stuff that generations will use and never get to actually feel and use the product themselves.
It's a rare privilege.
Oh, it is, yeah. I think when you sit here and spend your whole morning concentrating on everything that's going in front of you, the enormity for 18 and 20-year-olds who are certainly not as worldly wise as an 18-year-old today, it must have been real pressure and immense sense of not being scared, but thinking, what am I doing here? And then, of course, when they left here and they went home to Dad, and the first thing he says to them, what are you doing, my girl? That must have put even more pressure on a lot of the young ladies and the young men who worked here, because the enormity of what they were doing was obvious to them without them knowing hardly anything about the big picture. They were experts in their little world. Some of the diaries that Florence has shown us and we've worked on from the 19, 20, 25-year-old youngsters who were working in here, when you read between the lines, in tiny, tiny little letters, squeezing so many words onto a page of their diaries, you can see that the pressures they were under, in the way they expressed things, they said an awful lot of things without actually saying anything really, but you could tell by the way it's written sometimes and some of the words that they certainly had a lot of pressure, because they knew when they got it right, it probably saved lives. When they got it, or they thought they got it wrong, it was a big burden for the young people to bear.
For Broadway Building and Admiralty, please. Top Secret Ultra. Hut 3, Headline 454, CX-MSS-T262-117. At 1300 hours, 29th of July, 1944. Any German soldier without arms and not acting under orders, and any member of the auxiliary services, if found trying to escape from Riga in cowardly flight, is not to be sent away, but to be shot on the spot as a cowardly traitor.
These are strong words once again, aren't they? Can you explain a bit about what's going on here?
This message refers to the huge Soviet offensive that began in July 1944. There was always a plan that the Soviets would attack in the east to support the D-Day landing in the west. And that operation, which went under the codename of Operation Bagration — Bagration was a famous Russian general who served under the Tsar against Napoleon. The operation was in the sort of northern part of the Eastern Front, and it was enormously successful. The Soviets launched an enormous force into what we now know as Belarus and up towards the Baltic states, and it, you know, ripped a massive hole in the German defences. And at this point, at the end of July, the tip of the Soviet spear is about to hit the Baltic coast, and the whole of Estonia and Latvia would ultimately be cut off. And so on the 29th of July, you have a situation where Germans in Riga would have known that their escape route back to Germany is shortly going to be cut off. And, you know, it would have been very tempting to jump on the last train. But you see here the increasing intransigence of Hitler's military strategy. By the summer of 1944, Hitler has given up on any kind of strategic manoeuvre. His attitude to the war is not one step back. You know, it's the duty of every German soldier to fight and die where he is, and that retreat is no longer an option. Actually, a lot of his commanders were quietly arguing, and this is why the plot happened, quietly arguing that they needed to be much more flexible in their tactics. And for example, in Riga, pulling the troops out of there before it got cut off would be the sensible approach. You know, that's what a serious military commander would do. But Hitler's view was, no, if it's cut off, it doesn't matter. They've just got to stay there and fight on indefinitely and to the last bullet. And so this message reflects the climate in which that fighting is going on. And increasingly you see this through 1944 and into 1945, that tactical subtlety goes out of the window for the German army, and it's all about standing on the spot and fighting. And increasingly they take more and more draconian measures against their own troops to keep them fighting, and executions in the German army go up and up and up from this point onwards.
The Russian tide of progress continues to supply the Allies with heartening news. Each fresh advance carries the Red Armies into towns and villages where the mark of the invading beast is all too apparent. Let us follow the Soviet soldiers through one or two places in their stride westward, and with them come into contact with the revolting sights left behind by the Hun battalions. Soon there'll come a payday for murder. No German appeals for mercy, no political juggling or peace proposals will save them from the wages of their sins. Land's End for Hitler's divisions in the Kuban is the Kirsch Narrows. Notice to quit has been served on them by the Red Army, and wholesale withdrawal is in progress. For German audiences, the operation is explained as a shortening of their lines or elastic defense. Keeping them on the move are Russian bombers of the Red Air Force. Signs of occupation are flung down as the steady march westwards rids towns and villages of a hated invader. In the chain of successes so valiantly won is the town of Glukov in the northern Ukraine. One more place where misery and suffering have given way to indescribable relief. With heartening regularity, the Russian communiques announce their successes. Each triumph of Soviet arms is recognized with a fresh outburst from the victory guns of Moscow.
Clearly speaks of desperation, doesn't it? And it does make sense of the assassination plot, really.
It does, and it shows the dislocation from reality of Hitler's headquarters from that point on in the war, really.
I wonder what would have happened if he'd asked some of those people that plotted against him what they would do. It all might have turned out very differently.
Part of the background to that, the ambition of the plotters was, as I said before, that the existential threat to Germany was the war in the East. The war in the West could, they thought, be negotiated away with a bit of luck. And so their ambitions are to stop the Normandy campaign before it gets out of control, if you like. I mean, von Rundstedt is, there's a quote, again, like all these kind of things, it's debated by historians, but there's a story that he was consulted for his opinion when he was reporting the Allied breakthrough after Normandy. He was asked, what shall we do? And he replied, make peace, you idiots. And shortly after, lost his job. Again, you know, whether he actually said this, who he actually said it to, is always lost in the mists once you look at it too closely. but it shows the dislocation between Hitler and his cronies and the senior commanders out on the battlefield who see things very differently.
As a research historian, you must have rifled through the archives at Kew and spent so much time there looking at real paper documents. How much have you been able to research digitised versions of paper documents online in your work?
Very little is the answer.
So it's quite new as a way of making things available.
It's a really exciting way of making things available because the digital material that's available at the moment, the ultra messages that were sent out to commands, for example, are available online from the National Archives. But they're not searchable in the sense that you go to the particular file and you get a PDF that's 1,000 pages long with 1,000 messages in it. And the only way to find the message you want is to go through page by page. The fact that the headlines that we've got have been made searchable is a huge advantage because instead of having to wade through thousands of pages of messages, if there's a particular topic I want to look at, I can now just do a word search and find that material very, very quickly. And that's not a facility that's been freely available before.
So it's going to widen out the potential research audience, if you like, for the story of what happened here.
I would hope so, yeah. That's why we're doing it.
And of course, we talked to Florence about not having people's sticky mitts on pieces of paper that will degrade if you do. That would limit the number of people you could allow over time. You know, the more popular and widely known the story got, the more difficult that would be because you'd have to say no to most people wanting to come in and research. Whereas this will blow that wide open, won't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, it's the way archives are going all over the world, especially with evolving technologies for character recognition to recognise different types of scripts and for more subtle word searching systems to become available. And so the world of big data in archives, as it's called, is the coming thing at the moment. And, you know, I think 10 years from now, there'll be a whole different world of material available online that just isn't at the moment.
And it'll only be for television cameras that they get the old documents out now with the gloves.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy, write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.